Hey, John.
Hey, Drew.
You know, this podcast would be great if it wasn't for the f***ing listeners.
I'm Drew.
And I'm John.
And you're listening to The Hourchive,
our ever-growing library of everything, 1 hour at a time. Directors, part two.
Part
Electric
two.
Tarantino.
Oh. This one is about... I don't know if I even like what we're calling this one.
No?
Mainly because I don't think I pronounce it right.
Try it.
Auteurs.
That's pretty close.
Indie directors.
Auteur.
What do we
Scottish
mean?
Then.
It's a Scottish word. What do we mean by that?
We are talking about people, directors, who exert additional creative control over their works.
Almost in excess to a degree.
You could say so.
Of obsessiveness.
Yes, you could say so. To the point that their work is less known as each individual piece, but more part of the whole.
Often identifiable, right?
Yeah, yeah. Recognizable
as work.
Exhibiting the interests and embodying the interests and proclivities of the filmmaker.
Yeah.
For example, if you were to say that movie is a Tarantino movie, that movie is a Wes Anderson movie.
Yeah.
That movie is a blank movie.
Yeah.
You would be talking about
those directors.
Are the people we are going to be talking about.
Yeah. I don't know where to start.
Should we kind of have we have sort of an era in mind here. I think maybe that's a good place to sort of define some additional parameters. So we've like our previous directors podcast.
Yeah.
We've kind of come up with a brief list of names that I think we are going to talk about. This is not representative of everyone in this category, because I think that there are some outliers. But I think these are what the names that most readily come to mind.
Yeah.
So we'll talk about them. And if we want further to add some order to this, we could maybe talk about sort of chronologically their ascension, maybe starting with the earliest instance of them becoming a name.
Oh.
So, for example, we could start by talking about John Waters.
Okay. Let's
do
that.
Because I think of the modern era, I think he's probably been around the longest.
Yeah, let's do that. I like
John Waters.
Chronological approach.
All right. John Waters.
Does
Baltimore.
Anyone predate John Waters, though?
Probably, but...
Let's think about this for a second.
All right.
We're looking at directors who have a clear style, right? Mm-hmm. Stylistic approach and a sort of all hands, you know, hands in every pie kind of approach, right?
Yeah. The thing is, like, if you want to keep stretching it back further, you're going to go
further.
You're going to go way back.
Yeah.
You could go all the way back probably to, like, the beginning of movies, really. Because there was no industry, you had people who were doing everything.
Because they loved it.
Right.
They felt a...
Well, and they didn't have anybody else that they could trust.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
there
was sort of, this is what I'm making this.
Yeah.
And that's how it works. You didn't have a crew necessarily.
Yeah.
You just had a bunch of people that were sort of taking direction from this person. So in effect, it was like the very beginnings of... film, I think you could say, started with the director.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And his or her creative impulses were the final word.
Yeah.
And that probably didn't really change until the late 20s, early 30s, I guess, when studios start
getting their hands in there.
Yeah. Or at least start
financiers
overpowering. Right? Yeah.
I'm giving you all this money.
Right.
I'm going to have a say.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
John Waters.
John Waters has been around actually for a long time, but I first knew of him, I think, through Crybaby,
which is Johnny Depp.
Yeah, it was sort of a throwback. Most of his movies have some, they exude a 50s or 60s era aesthetic,
yeah,
even if they're not actually set in those eras. Mm-hmm. But Crybaby was very much in that vein.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of, I think, that element mixed with his sort of crassness or his subject matter, yeah, delving into what some might call areas of questionable taste. That's sort of his shtick. That's how he got his name.
Okay.
And I think he has never been as big a success as a name, as a name player.
Yeah, he's
as in a lot of the people who followed him.
He stayed very, I think, pretty, I mean, underground.
Yeah,
in a lot of ways. I think that he's sort of like, you know, I think a lot of filmmakers and fans of film know about John Waters,
mm-hmm,
whether they like his movies or not.
Yeah.
But I think the general public is fairly unaware.
Yeah, I would probably guess. Most likely.
I haven't seen very many of his movies. I don't know if I've seen any of his movies all the way through.
Hmm.
He did Hairspray.
Mm-hmm.
What are some other movies?
Crybaby,
Hairspray.
Hairspray, Pink Flamingos.
Did he do Ed Wood?
No, that was Burton.
That was
Tim Burton.
See, this too, I will say, John Waters and Tim Burton.
Yeah, Tim Burton.
There are some similarities there.
Yeah,
I don't think Tim Burton goes as far as John Waters in terms of the subject matter, you know?
Yeah.
Like, they both have this weird aesthetic. They both have... they both also kind of lean into that 50s, 60s era,
yeah,
look and feel.
But with like sort of a skewed.
Yeah. But I think filter. John Waters, you know, I definitely is edgier.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Than Burton. I mean, especially now, but even back when Tim Burton was, you know, still kind of like an odd guy.
Yeah.
I don't think he ever came close to what John Waters was doing.
No. And I think John Waters has always been a little more guerrilla in his approach, yeah, you know, and definitely at the start. Like, Tim Burton sort of came up through studios.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his first movie, his first feature was Pee-wee.
Yeah.
That was a big project, yeah. Whereas John Waters, now that I'm looking at this, goes way back. like, Pink Flamingos, I think, is the one that most people associate with him as kind of his start. He did make some like smaller movies before that, but that was 1972. Desperate Living was 1977. Wow. Polyester was 1981.
72.
Yeah, so he's been around a long time.
Yeah.
So he did Hairspray in the late 80s. He did Crybaby in 1990. Serial Mom is another one that
I think I saw that one.
That got like a fairly major release.
Is that with Kathleen Turner?
Turner.
Yeah.
Pecker. Which was, who was that kid?
Oh, Eddie
from
Furlong.
Terminator. True, yeah, Edward Furlong.
Edward.
Edward.
Yeah.
Cecil B. Demented,
uh-huh,
which I haven't seen, and A Dirty Shame, which I also haven't seen. So his last movie was Dirty Shame in 2004. And I don't know if he's just retired or if he's focusing on other stuff, but...
Let me ask you this. You may or may not be able to answer it. Maybe this is also a way to address each of these directors. I kind of feel like part of the definition of this is that these directors all have something to say.
Okay.
Like, mm-hmm. and generally, most of their movies kind of hit within a similar chord, mm-hmm. right? So, do you think you could determine what is John Waters' sort of message? Like, as far as his films go, what's the world he's showing you?
Mm. His movies all do have sort of a there's a clash, I think, in all of them. There's mm-hmm. like a culture clash mm-hmm. to all of them. Well, the other thing too that I guess comes through in a lot of his movies is the there's a sort of a confrontation of he's confronting what is considered to be acceptable, mm-hmm. I guess, or in good taste, right?
Yeah.
And maybe arguing that because something doesn't necessarily conform to a social norm doesn't necessarily mean that it's not pure or good or just as valuable.
Yeah.
He definitely has, I think of them, I think he has more of an agenda than many of the other ones.
Maybe more of a purposeful agenda.
Yes. I think not one that he exerts like aggressively. Which is interesting. He doesn't ever feel like he's sort of shoving that message at you.
But it does seem exacting and like he has it in mind. Do you know what I mean? Whereas I think with some of the other directors that we'll talk about, that I think it's more something that comes through, not necessarily because they intended it to, but that's just clearly kind of within their worldview.
Yeah. Yeah. It's probably a safe assumption. Good statement.
Thank you.
Brother of five, doing whatever I had to do to survive. I'm not saying what I did was all right. Trying to break out of the ghetto was a day-to-day fight. Being down so long, getting up didn't cross my mind. But I knew there was a better way of life, and I was just trying to find. You don't know what you do till you're put under pressure. Across 110th Street is a hell of a tester. Across 110th Street, pimps trying to catch a woman that's weak. Across 110th Street, pushers won't let the junkie go free. Across 110th Street, woman trying to catch a trick on the street. Across 110th Street, you can find it all in the street.
Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah. Okay. Well, his first movie was Reservoir Dogs.
Yes.
Which I saw, you know, long after it came out.
Then he made Pulp Fiction.
Mm-hmm.
In 94.
Mm-hmm.
Jackie Brown.
Uh-huh.
Kill Bill Volume 1.
Mm-hmm.
Kill Bill Volume 2.
Mm-hmm.
Then he made Death Proof, which was part of Grindhouse. Inglourious Basterds, and most recently Django Unchained.
So maybe it was after Kill Bill came out, and I hadn't seen any Tarantino films at that point.
Really?
Yeah.
Up until Kill Bill?
Yeah.
Wow.
And someone was like, everyone was like, you haven't seen Reservoir Dogs. And I said no, and so I watched it.
Was it Badger? From,
yeah,
from, you were hanging out with Badger and
he, from Breaking Bad. Yeah,
hey, Drew.
I remember, you know, I thought that's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
I still haven't seen Pulp Fiction ever.
That I find more surprising than the fact that you haven't seen Reservoir Dogs.
I don't know
or
if I ever can see it.
Hmm. Think it's too big.
I tried to watch it once, I think. But now it's like, it's a movie that, you know, how could I watch that movie now?
Yeah. Your worldview is already compromised.
I?
It's possible.
I mean, I missed it.
Yeah, you may have.
So I'm chalking that one up to a miss.
Sorry, Quentin.
But yeah, I saw Kill Bill 1 and 2, and then he did... I didn't see Death... Or which one's Death Proof?
That's from Grindhouse.
But which of the Grindhouse ones, which is that?
That's the one with the car.
Okay, I didn't watch that one.
Okay.
I watched the other one, Robert Rodriguez's. Yeah. Is,
who also, I don't know, maybe qualifies for this list.
Probably. Well, anyway, I didn't see Death Proof. I did see Inglourious Basterds, and I did see Django Unchained. Here's the thing about Quentin Tarantino. I kind of like to watch him when he talks about movies.
Ah, okay.
I think he's as entertaining to watch as his movies are.
When he's interviewed or espousing on
film or what have you, I feel like he's really interesting.
Yes.
In the things that he's thinking about and talking about. And I think that comes, you know, like his, to me, his worldview or his message is really kind of a celebration of movies.
Yes.
You know,
I'd endorse that statement as well.
And like the embellishment, you know, that movies have on real life,
the
like
heightening of
exactly.
Yes, the accentuation.
Yeah. And I think that comes through in pretty much every single movie he does, you know, and I think it's also in different ways, you know, I think different movies of his celebrate different aspects of movies, you know, be it a celebration of dialogue or a celebration of violence, you know, like I kind of think that each movie kind of has a different approach, but still falls within that overarching idea. Because I think of like, primarily I'm thinking of like Reservoir Dogs, you know, which is like, could be a play.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so it really relies on dialogue and storytelling. And I think it's, you know, people, and I think you could say this about a lot of the directors, people don't talk like the people in these movies, you know?
Right.
And no one is as eloquent as the people are in these movies.
Yeah. It's like aspirational dialogue. It's like the way you want all of your exchanges to come off.
And it's not even just the topics of conversation or what's being said, but it's like the cadence, you know, the rhythm of the dialogue and how the characters interplay and stuff like that. But yeah, I never saw Pulp Fiction or Jackie Brown. I never saw that one either.
See, that's my favorite of his movies.
Yeah,
Jackie
Brown's favorite.
Why? I like it a lot.
Why?
Why? Part of it's
why?
Because it's part of it's because I think it's his unsung classic. You know, it's sort of forgotten. But and then probably because it's sandwiched in between Pulp Fiction and Kill Bill,
right?
Which are so, those are statement movies, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, they're so aggressive in what they're doing. And Jackie Brown is a much quieter movie. But I think going back to the dialogue thing, I feel like the dialogue in Jackie Brown feels more realistic than anywhere else. And that may be because it was the only one of his movies, I think. Yeah, only one of his movies that was based on existing material.
Okay.
It was based on a book called Rum Punch. So that may account for part of that. But that said, it was still a departure from that original story. The other reason that I love Jackie Brown is that it's his love story, I guess, you could say. And there's a really great relationship between Jackie Brown, who is a flight attendant, who is also on the side running money back and forth for a gun dealer, and her bail bondsman, who is... just sort of drifting.
Yeah.
He's just kind of drifting. And he meets Jackie Brown, and I think he's sort of... my impression is that he becomes infatuated with her because she is such a dynamic personality, mm-hmm. and there's nothing about him that's remarkable. You know, he's just doing his thing, and he meets her, and they have they have kind of a partnership, I guess,
yeah.
that develops over the course of the movie. And I think in a lesser movie, it would have devolved too much into the predictable mix of, you know, what happens when their emotional relationship gets in the way of their business relationship, mm-hmm. you know, and that would have been the story. But that's not the way he goes,
okay.
you know. And I think he goes in a much more interesting direction, a more unusual direction. I don't know. That's just their interaction, and that movie, I think, to me, has his most human moments in it. There are two scenes in particular where I don't think this will give anything away, but there's a moment in most of Tarantino's movies, and I've gotten to the point now where I watch for it, where a character will either pause and just do nothing and just be either standing or sitting alone by themselves, alone.
Yeah.
almost as though like they're taking a moment to think about what they're about to do.
Yeah.
You know, or they're giving themselves a pep talk or something, or mm-hmm. they are literally doing that. They're literally giving themselves a pep talk. An example. So in Pulp Fiction, there's a scene where John Travolta is talking to himself and basically coaching himself for what he's about to do.
Okay.
And then Kill Bill has a scene where Uma Thurman, she's just woken up from a coma.
Yeah.
She's clawed her way out to a car in the parking lot of the hospital.
Yeah.
She can't move her legs, but she sits in the back of the car and she basically wills her body to do what she needs to do.
Yep.
She like tells herself to physically do things. Jackie Brown has this great scene where Jackie is about to, she's sort of at the point of no return where she's conning a couple of different groups of people.
Mm-hmm.
And she's been leading up to this moment. This is, and up until this point, she still has the chance to back away from this
mm-hmm.
and do what those people are expecting her to do. And what happens after this, once, if she makes this choice, then that's all done. She's gone over that edge. You know, there's no turning back. And she's sitting in this department store. What do you call that room?
Changing room?
Yeah, yeah. The try-on room where you go into try-on clothes.
Changing room.
Fitting room. Fitting room. That's it. I don't use the fitting room. But there's a great scene where Jackie Brown is in the fitting room.
How fitting.
And she's trying to talk herself into this mentally, you mm-hmm. know. That moment's great. And then there's another moment where the bail bondsman, Max Cherry, does sort of the same thing. You know, he's led a very strict legal life up until this point. And what he's doing, while not in the context of the movie, is not bad. What he does is questionable in terms of legality.
Right.
And he stops midway. And he does this thing where he's about to get into his car after just having done this, and he turns around and he looks behind him,
mm-hmm.
and there's nobody coming, and he knows that there's nobody coming, but he still turns and looks around anyway,
mm-hmm.
and then he just sort of smiles to himself and gets in the car and drives away. And that those two scenes are my favorite Tarantino scenes ever, and they're so human, and I feel like everybody has probably had a moment like one of those.
Yeah,
that's Jackie Brown.
I guess I need to see it.
See it.
So the thing that I like about Tarantino, and I think this is another sort of shared trait these types of directors, is his movies all kind of happen within one universe.
Yeah.
And you can see connections from movie to movie. Mm-hmm. And they're not necessarily spelled out for you, but if you look for them, you can usually find them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for instance, like I think the Vince Vega...
Yes.
Is that Reservoir Dogs?
That's Pulp Fiction.
Pulp Fiction.
Yeah.
His brother, I think, is in Reservoir Dogs.
Is in Reservoir Dogs. Vic Vega.
Vic Vega. You've got, there's a brand of cigarettes that are mm-hmm. seen throughout. It's like Red Apple.
Red Apple.
Cigarettes.
Big Kahuna Burger shows up in a couple of them.
And the most interesting thing is that there's the Tarantino universe of characters and situations. And then within that universe, there's a second universe of movies that these characters would go to see.
Right.
So the theory that I've read, I think Tarantino has confirmed, yes, these all happen within one universe, and yes, some of these are movies within that universe.
Yeah.
But the theory is that you have the movie universe, which is stuff like Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction. It's very violent, you know, universe and crass. And that is because within that universe, based on Inglourious Bastards, and this is a spoiler alert, spoiler for all, any and all
probably
movies we'll talk about. But Inglourious Bastards is sort of a revenge fantasy film where it's set in World War II era, and at the end of it, the heroes kill Hitler, and they do it in this movie theater, and they kill him, and then simultaneously another group blows up the theater and kills everyone in it. And so the theory being that because of this, you know, intense, you know, violent, sudden, you know, destruction of life within a movie theater, this spurs on a culture for the following years of, you know, of violence and sort of a lack of value over human life.
Right.
So you have these really intense, violent stories within the movie universe. And then the movie within a movie universe is even
takes that even further.
Because these are the movies that those people would want to go see.
Right.
So the movie in a movie universe is the Kill Bill movies, mm-hmm. where it's even, you know, in more insanely violent. And recently with Django Unchained, I think people are saying that that's within the movie universe, so the mm-hmm. you know, the real in quotes
mm-hmm.
setting. But I would argue, to me, it feels more like it's in the context of the movie within a movie. One, because of the you know, incredible amount of violence in mm-hmm. it, particularly toward the end. But also, it has a reference to a Kill Bill segment where she in Kill Bill 2.
Yeah.
It starts with her buried alive.
Yeah.
And she's in the grave of someone whose last name is Schwartz.
Schultz.
Yeah.
Paula Schultz.
Right.
Lonesome grave of Paula Schultz.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And her death is 1850.
I can't remember.
Something. Like,
but it precedes the action of what's in.
Right.
Inglourious Basterds.
Django Unchained.
Yeah.
And one of the main characters in Django Unchained is Dr. King Schultz.
Yeah.
And he says that he used to be a dentist, but that 5 years ago, his wife, or was it his daughter?
I thought it was his daughter.
His daughter was, or died. I don't know if he says she was killed, but
yeah.
she's dead. And since then, he's been a bounty hunter. And so what some people have theorized is that, you know, his daughter was killed in some horrible way.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is sort of his way of kind of dealing with that death. And the theory is that Paula Schultz was his daughter.
Yeah, which is cool. And Tarantino has not, as far as I know, has not commented on
right.
that link.
Yeah.
Right. But he did say that there was
a connection
in Django Unchained to
yeah.
his other movies, or at least one of his other movies. And he said it was so incidental that you wouldn't really notice it,
right?
Unless you were really scrutinizing.
Well, there
it.
Was
so that makes sense.
There is a Big Apple cigarettes ad in Django Unchained.
Ah, okay.
He's also said that Django and what's her name? Hilda.
Oh, Hildy. Yeah.
Hilda.
Brumhilda.
Hildegard.
Yeah. Brumhilda von Schaft.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. They're, you know, in his mind, they are the great great grandparents of John Schaft.
Right. Right.
From the Schaft movies. Which is pretty great.
That's
good.
He
just
yeah.
puts that in. And then one last little tidbit, there is one movie of his that does not fit into the universe, and that's Jackie Brown.
Weird.
All right.
Tarantino.
from here, we go to Kevin Smith.
Yeah.
Who, around the same time, a little bit later.
Yeah. I think Clerks was 94. Yeah. So right after.
And I think Tarantino. I think he made it in 93.
Yeah.
And then it got released in 94.
Yeah. But yeah. Which is really probably right around the time where this whole movement,
yeah,
I guess,
started. He was definitely part of it. But yeah, like on the latter end of it.
Yeah.
I think it's a really short time period.
Yeah.
You know, where we're a bunch of directors, indie directors,
yeah,
you know, sort of got their start, and I think Kevin Smith came in, you know, right at the end.
Mm-hmm.
But he also became, I think, one of the biggest sort of examples of that movement. And so his, you know, his first movie was Clerks. His movies all take place, not all of them, but there is a what he calls the Askewniverse,
yeah,
because his film company was the View Askew Productions. So in the Askewniverse, as it is, really only consists of his first five movies.
Yeah.
And so that's Clerks, Mallrats, Chasing Amy, Dogma, and Jay and Silent Bob
Strike Back.
And I was trying to think of like what his, you know, what could you say Kevin Smith's sort of like worldview is, or his message, and like it's kind of hard to pinpoint. Again, he's like a dude who really fixates on dialogue,
mm-hmm,
you know, especially in those early movies where it's all, you know, no one talks like this, but it's just you wish you did.
Yeah.
You know, you wish you had conversations like that.
Yeah.
But he, I think he kind of, with those first, it's hard for me to look at things beyond the first five movies, because he definitely starts going in other directions after that.
Yeah.
You know, for better or for worse, but you could almost say he's kind of talking about Jersey in a way, you know.
Yeah, sort of suburban Jersey.
Yeah, he that's especially with those first five movies, but even after that, things like Jersey Girl.
Yeah.
You know, he still sort of started to keep it in that universe, but I think he, for him, it's more of just like life. Like this is, you know, it's slice of life kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I think he's just trying to put forward like his observations on, oh, I forgot Clerks 2 is, yeah, in the Askewniverse, of course. His sort of like, he's sort of presenting life as he sees it. And mm-hmm, and I think he also presents it based on where he is in his life.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. I think he's, in a way, he's working out sort of,
yeah,
things that he's encountering.
We're kind of along for the ride as he takes, you know, the various things that are affecting him in his life at the time and puts them into a movie.
Yeah.
You know, so Clerks, you have a guy who feels like he's sort of stuck,
mm-hmm,
you know, and has no way out. And, you know, at the time, Kevin Smith himself was working at the video store where it's filmed,
right,
and the Quickie Mart where it's filmed. And then, you know, Mallrats was kind of just
a bit of an anomaly.
Yeah. And it's sort of like, I'm trying to think if there's, it seems more like of him just sort of like, these are the things I like to talk about,
mm-hmm,
comics, movies, flea markets, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what went into Mallrats. And then Chasing Amy is, you know, even deeper into comics. And I think also creators of things, you know.
Yeah.
Because that's one of his movies that focuses on someone who's making something.
Yeah. It's sort of the insider's,
yeah,
view of, yeah. And at that point, you know, you can sort of swap him and,
yeah,
what's his name? Holden?
Holden.
You know, it just, if you took that movie and set it in the movie world,
yeah,
you know, you would have Kevin Smith basically there, where he's had indie successes,
mm-hmm,
but he's not like still not a household name,
yeah,
or anything.
Well, and then that sort of carried over, and I'll skip Dogma just for a second, but that carries through with Jay and Silent Bob, where Holden's property is then appropriated by a major studio.
Yeah.
And Holden himself isn't involved, but the other character, Banky,
yeah,
Jason Lee's character in the movie, he's the one who's sort of like pushing
for that.
Yeah,
that's right.
You know?
Yeah.
And Jay and Silent Bob is interesting just because it's sort of like his last hurrah in that universe. At least that's what was the claim was at the time.
Yeah.
And it was sort of fan service the whole way through, where it seemed like he just wanted to have a lot of fun making a movie.
Yeah.
And he got out all of his friends, and which included his friends that were in the industry.
Yeah.
To be in it and help him make it and stuff like that.
And it doesn't really hold up if you're not
right
into
it,
those other movies.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But going back to Dogma, you know, that's his film on religion and sort of how I think he came back to religion and faith. And then he has Jersey Girl, which is his first attempt at something outside of his universe, which, you know, I think suffered unfortunately from just what was going on at the time in the film industry with Ben Affleck and Jennifer Lopez. And I think it's a much better movie than it's given credit for.
I think it's great. Doesn't George Carlin plays his dad?
George Carlin is his dad and does an awesome job. And
that's that is honestly one of Ben Affleck's best performances, I think.
Yeah.
I think he did a great job.
I do too.
Yeah.
I think Ben Affleck's, some of his best performances are in
Kevin Smith
movies.
Yeah, they sort of, I think he's acknowledged this too, that he sort of feels like Ben Affleck is sort of his muse or something. Yeah. Not to be confused with Jason Muse.
That's his real muse.
Yeah.
But then he did, I'm trying to think if after Jersey Girl did Clerks 2.
Yeah.
So now he's back in the Esk universe. But the interesting thing is, like, I feel like by this point he's dropped all the baggage of like being an indie director or doing what is expected of him as a director versus what's expected of him by his fans, etc. Like, I think by that point he's sort of just saying, I just want to make the movies I want to make with the people that I want to make them with. So he made Clerks 2, which I thought was pretty good.
Way better than I expected.
Yeah. And it was, the cool thing was he took those characters and in the same way that when he first wrote Clerks, he sort of like, this is my life.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, here's how I feel like where I am. And then he took those characters and he's like, well, what are those characters like at my age now? You know, if I fast forward those characters to where I am, what are they doing? And sort of like, how are they feeling? And I think it's almost like his what if movie, like what if I had not gotten out of the video store or the Quickie Mart, you know, where would I be?
I never thought of it that way.
And then he does the cop movie, I think.
Cop Out. It's called.
Yeah. Which was all right.
I didn't see that.
That was the first time he did a movie that wasn't something he wrote.
His source material. Yeah.
And then you know what? I'm not sure if Cop Out came next or if it was Zach and Miri Make a Porno.
I think Zach and Miri came after Cop Out.
Which I love that movie.
That was a great movie, yeah.
Zach and Miri was, and it's not within the universe.
Right.
But it's awesome. I think that's one of his best movies.
Yeah, I agree.
And then he did either Cop Out. It was either Cop Out or Zach and Miri, right?
Mm-hmm.
One or the other. And then he did Red State, right?
Yes. Oh, gosh, I forgot about Red State.
So Red State was a huge departure.
Yeah, what a weird... Well, and that, again, coming out of stuff that's going on in his life, you know, that was, I think he, based on Dogma, probably initially.
Dogma, and then also he actually had a lot of, not a lot, but he was, at this point, he's on Twitter a lot.
Yeah.
He's started his podcasts. And he's
become a personality at this point. Yeah.
And he's interacting with the Phelpses.
Yeah.
Particularly Megan Phelps, who's on Twitter, I guess.
Yeah.
And I think he's like, I'm going to make a movie about like some radical religious nuts sort of thing. And, and also I think it was an endeavor for him to like stylistically try something different.
Yeah.
And it's complete. You would never, I don't think you would ever think this was a Kevin Smith movie.
If you
movie.
Had no idea, you couldn't watch it and say Kevin Smith made that.
Yeah. Well, and also like the other thing about this sort of being in line with where he was in his life is like he released it online simultaneously, or even maybe even before it was in theaters.
First, didn't he do the road show?
He did the road show,
and then I think it was on demand and
he announced, I think, alongside the release, that he was going to start distributing movies, or set up a new way to distribute movies, I don't know if anything ever came of that. Actually,
I haven't heard much,
because he got really involved in his podcasts, right now. The last that I've heard, he was working on a movie based on the song by Warren Zevon. What's it called? It was going to be a hockey movie.
Oh, Hit Somebody.
Hit Somebody, yeah. Which now is going to be a series.
TV series?
Yeah. But the last thing he talked about was another Clerks movie.
Which I think I just read, did you see today even, there was an announcement that now he's considering making that a novel instead of a movie, which raises the question, if it's true as he claims that he's only going to do one more movie, and he still has yet to do that movie, then neither Hit Somebody nor Clerks 3 is going to be that movie. So there's still something out there.
Yeah. I think, you know, like his view, I think, was more consistent early on.
Yeah.
But I got really into his movies for a while.
Yeah.
You know, especially those early movies. And I think of them all, my favorite might be Mallrats.
That's the one that I come back to the most.
Yeah.
And it's definitely the most watchable.
It's the one that did the worst.
Yeah.
Of all his movies, it's probably his least successful.
But I would argue probably did more for making an audience for him than any of the other ones did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Clerks was sort of like an indie favorite, but
I think it kind of came back after, you know, home release. Like,
yeah.
It found its audience.
Yeah.
And also, I've said before, it has an awesome commentary track.
Oh, right. Yeah.
That's really pretty, almost as funny as the movie itself. He's interesting. I mean, it's interesting how, you know, how much he involves his audience in his life.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he is completely open about his life and sort of what goes on, not just because of his podcast, but like he's done a series of these, you know, talks, an evening with Kevin Smith series that are really great. And he tells some pretty incredible stories. And I think maybe that's why I like him as much as I do, is I think he's an amazing storyteller.
Yeah. Maybe not so gifted a filmmaker.
Yeah.
But
the
great
stories,
even
just like as a raconteur, you know, like the guy can really tell a story.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's got some great ones.
Yeah.
That's Kevin Smith.
Kevin Smith.
Não consegue compreender o que a mente não faz questão. Tem forças pra obedecer. Quantos sonhos já destruí e deixei escapar das mãos. Se o futuro assim permitir, não pretendo viver em vão. Meu amor, não estamos sós. Tem um mundo a esperar por nós. No infinito do céu azul pode ter vida em Marte, então vem cá, me dá sua língua. Então vem, quero abraçar você. Seu poder vem do sol.
I think after him, you get into, I guess Guillermo del Toro probably came after him.
What was his first?
His first movie was Kronos.
I never saw that.
Which is kind of a trippy vampire kind of movie. But I think he got big with, he did the Blade movies. He did Blade 2.
Mm-hmm.
And he did, I think he did Mimic, maybe?
Mimic.
I'm trying to think.
Okay.
So he did sort of like, kind of horror, very slick horror movies. But I think where he started really coming into his own was with Devil's Backbone and Pan's Labyrinth. Those two, I think, were... what he's really good at is blending sort of fantasy and really grim reality.
Yeah.
And I think those two kind of typify that.
I appreciate his approach to filmmaking overall. Mm-hmm. Like, he seems like the kind of guy who really embraces practical effects, you mm-hmm. know, some makeup and models and costume, you know, like all mm-hmm. the, because in a world that we are in now where so much is done digitally mm-hmm. and done, you know, really well a lot of the time, mm-hmm. He is one of the directors, I think, who's really appreciates the charm and the sort of like the realism that you get from an actual thing, you mm-hmm. know? Mm-hmm. And so I think you can see that in a lot of his movies where, you know, primarily everything's in camera. Mm-hmm. You know, there's there aren't these huge digital set pieces. Mm-hmm. And like, you know, thinking like Hellboy.
Yeah.
Because he did both of those, you know. And I don't think either of them are like great movies, mm-hmm. but I think they're just really like, they're beautiful to look at.
His care shows through.
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. And I would think that if you're a Hellboy fan, I would have to think you're pretty pleased, like just from the look, you know?
Yeah.
And exactly. His care, he's clearly very attentive.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that.
Yeah.
And he has had, I still feel like his best work is yet to come.
I agree.
Which is maybe not the same that I would say for all the other names on this. Yeah. I feel like he still has potential to reach, you know?
And his newest movie looks, you know, it doesn't look great. Pacific Rim.
Pacific Rim, yeah. Well, did he direct it or did he just produce it?
I think he directed it, didn't he?
Oh, really?
Maybe he just produced it. I don't know.
Yeah.
But I like the from what I can tell from the trailers, I like the conceit, mm-hmm. but it also has a lot of sort of corniness to it, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think this is sort of like kind of an ongoing struggle I see with his movies that I've seen. Mm-hmm. I think Pan's Labyrinth didn't have this problem.
Right.
But a lot of his movies kind of are a little too jokey or corny or kind of like, you know, winking. Mm-hmm. And Pan's Labyrinth to me was where he kind of like hit the right balance of, you know, sort of weirdness, good story, mm-hmm. and the fantasy versus reality, you know, or which is scarier, you know,
right,
in a
yeah.
way. And he didn't lapse into sort of the goofiness of it, you know. But I think you're right. I think that he has yet to really like kind of hit his stride and put forth his best effort.
Yeah. But yeah. I think he's maybe aware of that too.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think he's
well,
really,
he seems like he's
in a really smart balance, I think, of proving himself.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a project he's been associated with At the Mountains of Madness, which is that H.P. Lovecraft. Yeah. That I feel like if anybody's ever going to get Lovecraft right, it's probably going to be him.
I mean, I feel like if he does, the movie's going to be unwatchable. You know, like the myth, the Cthulhu mythos is just kind of terrible. And I don't mean terrible as in like bad. I just mean like it's sort of a horrific concept. And I agree with you. He's the guy who could do it.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of like scared of what that would be.
How that's going to manifest. Yeah.
But I really hope that he makes that a reality, because I know it is something that's been
his life's work, in his docket
for a long time.
Yeah.
And he was attached. He was going to direct The Hobbit.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, he was the director on that for years. And unfortunately, because of various like logistical issues or financial issues or governmental issues that plagued the production of that film, even getting off the ground, he had to leave it because he had other commitments. And when he signed on for The Hobbit, you know, it was supposed to be, I think, like 3 years. And it, you know, the 3 years came and went, and the movie hadn't even started production yet.
Yeah.
And so he's like, I hate to, but I can't do this, you know. And I think it would have been, as much as I'm glad that Peter Jackson, you know, ended up doing The Hobbit, mm-hmm. you know, I would have loved to see Guillermo del Toro's approach.
Yeah, definitely.
Because I think it would have been wildly different, you know, and I think it could have been as good as Peter Jackson's, you know?
Yeah. In a different way.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
All right.
Wes Anderson. Should we even talk about Wes Anderson?
Are we the right people to talk about Wes Anderson?
That's a good question. I don't know that we are.
I've seen many. I've seen several of his films. Mm-hmm. I get him confused with What's-His-Face. There's another Anderson. Something Thomas Anderson?
Paul Thomas Anderson?
Is he a director?
Yeah.
But he's not Wes Anderson.
No.
Wes Anderson is the Mount Rushmore. Rushmore?
Rushmore, Royal Tenenbaums.
Bottle Rocket.
Yes, that was his first one, I think.
He's somewhat responsible for the Owen brothers.
Yes, he created them. He brought them, brought them into this world in the year 1996.
I don't know why, but I'm generally averse to his movies.
I am too. I just can't sit through them.
I liked the Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed that. What were his, I feel like there's another one that I liked. So
he did the Life Aquatic,
Didn't do a whole lot for me. The Tenenbaums, Darjeeling Unlimited.
Most recently, Moonrise Kingdom. has he done anything else?
I guess I just don't. The aesthetic is not one that I really feel like immersing myself in. Mm. I'm trying to think if, I don't know if we could really effectively do it, but I'm trying to think of what his vision or what he's saying, you know. And I think maybe there's just this sense of offbeatness or the celebration of strange people and quirkiness. I think that's actually kind of a really shallow assessment.
Yeah.
I imagine there is something much deeper than that. Because while I don't necessarily enjoy his movies, I do think that they are that he is not unjustly celebrated. Like, I can see there's substance there.
Yeah.
And I just simply am not interested in it.
I think, yeah, and there's definitely a reason why his name is...
Yeah.
Like, he has a very clear aesthetic. And I think it's... I think his trailers look great.
Yeah.
And that's about as far as I'm willing to go.
Although I think he's been unfairly pegged in some respects as sort of the hipster director.
Yeah.
And I think he was around way before that movement.
Oh,
and doing these movies before that kind of aesthetic became, if anything, he's the reason some hipsters exist, right?
Yeah. I think they adopted that culture sort of took on the Tenenbaums as
exactly.
Sort of
I think he predates it and will post-date it.
Yeah,
you know
agreed.
What I mean? So I think that's sort of an unfair kind of attachment a label given to him, you know? So we probably can't really go too in-depth on
which
on
is
him.
Fine.
Yeah.
Because we're running out of time.
We're out of time. But we got to talk about Edgar Wright.
Yeah. Talk about Edgar Wright.
I'll talk about him. He hasn't done many films. I mean, if you look at the number of films that the other directors on the list have done, Edgar Wright is, you know, behind. Yeah. But he directed Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, Scott Pilgrim versus the World. So those are, I think, just the three films. He also did a show called Spaced, which was before all of those, which is great, great show.
And he did a trailer in Grindhouse.
Yeah. So his movies, the Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, are both part of what he calls his Cornetto trilogy. And Cornetto is a ice cream bar or ice cream cone kind of thing in England, I think. And in both movies, the character goes and gets a Cornetto. And so the third one is what is his next release, is the third movie in his Cornetto trilogy. And that is going to be called The World's End, I think. And he kind of, I think he's similar to Tarantino in some respects, in so much as he's really sort of celebrating film. And I think what's awesome about his filmmaking is you can really dig into it. Like, he puts so many references and sort of nods to other films in his movies. And very few of them are like on the surface, like in your face. It's all stuff that you would have to know a lot about that particular genre to pick up on them. So in Shaun of the Dead, I think there's, you know, it's replete with zombie movie references.
Right.
And Hot Fuzz is replete with cop movie references. And Hot Fuzz is probably in my top five favorite movies. And Scott Pilgrim is probably in my top five favorite movies. He's really good with... I think there's a lot of charm to his movies, you know, like the characters in his movies are all really likable. Even the ones that are jerks, I think are like really likable jerks. You know?
Yeah. They're definitely watchable.
Jerks. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I love the cadence of his movies and sort of the flow of them. And he has this cool thing he does in both Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, where he lays out the plot for you at a certain point. Like you don't know what's happening, but he basically in the dialogue describes what's going to happen for the rest of the movie. And then if you go back and watch that scene, you're like, oh, that's, he just sort of laid it all out. And in Shaun of the Dead, it's in the sequence where the two main characters are at the Winchester, the bar, sort of drowning their sorrows. And, I think Ed is his name in the movie, Nick Frost, his character sort of says, here's what we're going to do. We're going to, you know, do this, 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 this to deal with your breakup. And that in, you know, recontextualized describes what happens for the rest of the movie, but in a zombie, you know.
Yeah, in a completely different context. Yeah.
And then the same thing happens in Hot Fuzz, where one of the characters describes the final showdown of the movie in so many words. It's cool stuff. I'm really excited to see where he goes, because I think also maybe he's not done his best yet.
Kind of thinking about that. Although, man, Scott Pilgrim is such a great movie.
Well, yeah, and that's the anomaly of his, you know, admittedly small collection of movies right now. But I don't know how that movie missed its audience.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know why more people aren't talking about the movie, because it is really good. And it's you know, it's based on a comic series by Brian Lee O'Malley. I think that's his name. Set in Toronto. It's funny because I tried to read the comics and I couldn't really get into them, mostly because of the drawing style. It just didn't really jive with me.
Powerpuff Girl.
Yeah. And so the movie excited me, because I love the concept of, like, the premise is that this guy falls for a girl, but in order to date her, he has to fight and defeat her seven exes. And, you know, it's full of, like, video game references and...
It's structured, like, with each of those as like, the boss of a certain level of the video game.
And it's awesome. I mean, it's so well done.
Yeah.
And like, I think it's also really well paced, and I'm glad it's a thing where they could have done several movies, but they kept it to one, and I think that was smart.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it came at a time when, A, people were sick of Michael Cera. And, you know,
I think that probably that's one of the big reasons. Yeah.
But he's great in it.
Yeah, he is. Everybody is.
And also, I just don't think it was really marketed maybe to the right people or in the right way, you know, because I think the effects are really cool and it does stuff that like I felt like I should have seen by now in movies, you know, and it's clear that Edgar Wright had a blast like making this movie.
Yeah.
Because it's so fun to watch.
I think everybody did. I think you get the sense watching it that everybody involved with it was having a good time.
Yeah.
Kieran Culkin is amazing in that movie.
Yes, he is. He steals pretty much every scene he's in.
I also wonder if maybe like the way it was released, you know, it had a pretty big opening, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, not fiscally, but it was like, you know, it was heavily promoted,
widely released.
And I sort of wonder if maybe like if it had been distributed in a more underground sort of way, if it had been able to build a cult following before it was really released,
yeah,
if maybe that would have made a difference.
Maybe. I'm trying to think of what he's saying. It's hard to say at this point because he's only got the three movies.
I don't know if he has any. I mean, he definitely.
Well, if you only base it off of his existing movies, and you almost can't take Scott Pilgrim into account because it's not his property. You know what I mean?
Like, right.
He didn't write it.
Right.
I think he's you know, interested right in relationships or friendships between guys, you know?
Like, yeah.
If you look at the two movies he's made, Shaun of the Dead and Hot Fuzz, or even if you look at the show Spaced.
Yeah.
It's about, although Spaced is more about, I think maybe the friendship between the two, the guy and the girl, their roommates.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's interested in relationships and friendship and sort of like what different friendships look like.
Mm.
Because it is the friendship in Space is an interesting one because they're sort of an odd pairing and they never lapse. I don't think they ever lapse into romantic relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with Shaun of the Dead, you've got the two friends. One's kind of a loser and the other's a loser in a different way, but you know, and how they kind of rely on one another and you see the reason that they're friends.
Yeah.
And then Hot Fuzz, you know, starts with two people who are antagonists, but eventually kind of find the common ground.
It's almost like his movies sort of set you up thinking that they're going to be about one relationship and then reveal that.
Well, and Hot Fuzz is actually really interesting because originally in the script, he had a female love interest for the main character. And he eventually took all of that female love interest's lines and gave them to the buddy, the cop.
Huh.
And you can see it. You can totally see how this could have been the story of the main character, Nicholas Angel, falling in love with, you know, this woman or this female cop from a small town. And yet he's sort of falling in love with this friend, you know.
That's awesome.
And there's even a moment where the two characters have finally kind of come together for the first time and felt on equal footing. And they're standing outside of the one's apartment after having drinks at a bar. And the guy's like, "Do you want to come inside and have another beer?" And he's, you know, and so he goes inside and he's like, they're sitting on the couch looking at each other, you know, sort of just eye to eye. And the one's like, "You never really switch off, do you?" And he's like, "I don't know how." And the other guy goes, "I can show you how." And like, there's this pregnant pause and you're like, "No." And then he gets up and he goes and he opens up his, these two doors, and then you see his movie library, and they proceed to watch Point Break. But it was such a great, like, it's like, oh man, once you know that originally that character was a female love interest for him, it's so awesome that he decided to take that out completely and make it just about these friends.
Pursue a more, yeah, unique storyline. Yeah.
So I'm excited for the next one, the World's End.
Yeah, I'm intrigued.
Yeah.
Hope he keeps it up. I think he will.
I don't know if we do. We,
we, I think that, we learn? That, that, what did we learn?
What did we learn from this?
I think
we meandered a bit, but
we need to watch more movies.
Yeah, you're right. There's more to come on this subject.
Yeah.
And we know we missed people. And once again, God, we're suck at talking about the ladies.
The ladies. You know, well, I had Sofia Coppola on the list, but I don't know that she really fits within this within this realm. And
maybe
I think
we need to do a lady director's episode.
We might have to do that. Although I hate the idea part of the problem being like, here's the concession. We got to do one. Yeah.
No. We won't do that.
Figure it out.
But we'll
Yeah.
All right. Well, pop it in the archive.